Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and really crazy martinis for conservatives today. Jim, we begin with the good, and it's one we've talked about quite a bit over the past couple of weeks, and that's the nomination of CIA Director Mike Pompeo to be the next Secretary of State. There was some question there for a while as to whether Pompeo would actually get confirmed, despite easily being confirmed as CIA director, and there really being no comprehensible reason for opposing him other than the fact that Donald Trump nominated him for this position. But we got some good news on Monday in a couple different ways. Mike Pompeo has cleared the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and it happened because of two things. Number one, Rand Paul, the one Republican on the committee that had announced previously that he would oppose the Pompeo nomination, finally decided to support it in committee and presumably on the floor. Here's his explanation to Fox Business for changing his mind.
I think we talked more in general terms, and I don't think it's really appropriate to try to pin him down on, hey, we have to leave by next week or I'm not voting for him. But I heard loud and clear from the president, and I tell you loud and clear and with very specific language that he's very much in my, with me on a lot of the ideas that we've been at war too long in too many places. And I think people are going to be surprised over the next year or two that I think there will be some ending of some of the wars around the world.
If it had failed in committee, it could have been brought to the floor, but the Senate Democrats could have had the opportunity to throw a wrench into the works and require 60 votes for confirmation. That won't happen now, but it almost did anyway, because Bob Corker, who we talked about yesterday with the less than enthusiastic endorsement of Marsha Blackburn, decided to hold the committee vote on a day he knew that one of his members wouldn't be there. Johnny Isaacson of Georgia was down back in his home state eulogizing his best friend, and so he wasn't there, and his proxy apparently didn't count for whether or not the Democrats could use this tactic. So thankfully, Chris Coons, being the one adult on the Democratic side, decided to change his vote to present, so it passed the committee, and now it goes to the floor. There's already three Democrats who say they'll vote for it there, so I don't think we're going to have any problems, Jim. So thankfully we got there, but it was more awkward than it should have been.
Yeah, and we can have a couple of quibbles with Senator Paul and ask, you know, is it really a dramatically different version of Mike Pompeo at the beginning of their conversation than there is at the end of the conversation? I think Mike Pompeo is the same guy. But, if Rand Paul wants some assurances that Pompeo shares some of the same concerns about the length of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, the troops we have in Iraq and in Syria trying to train groups against ISIS, intervention in the Horn of Africa and Yemen and places like that. All right, okay, that's what it takes. That's what it takes. The variations of this have happened on a lot of nominees over the years. You and I have often said some variation. If I ever were up for the hearing, my response to every senator would be, whatever you say, Senator. Yes, I agree. Is that what it takes to get to yes? Fine. Then I think the moon's made of green cheese, if that's what it takes. That's a version likely of what Pompeo is playing here. Also, a rare day when you and I say, attaboy, Chris Coons, that this was the, as you said, the grown-up thing to do. Look, we know Pompeo has the votes. And what's more, no one's made a particularly good argument against Pompeo on ethics. Or the idea that he's not qualified for the position. As I mentioned, if anything, he's probably much more qualified than Rex Tillerson was. Voting no means you don't like this president, you don't like his foreign policy. Okay, yeah, we got it. We had our first clue when you were in the Democratic Party, and this president and his Secretary of State are in the Republican Party. You're going to have some differences. For a long time, policy differences were not considered sufficient reason to vote against a nominee who was otherwise qualified and ethical and checked all the boxes. Chris Coons is kind of recognizes the ridiculousness of this particular setup. He gets reported favorably out of committee. We'll get him confirmed. We'll get him into position. And then hopefully there'll be a little bit more structure and order to this administration's foreign policy. Because if you're heading into negotiations with North Korea and other high stakes issues like that, I think you want to have a fully staffed administration and a Secretary of State in place, and he can start getting his deputies and undersecretaries and all those guys. I think, you want to face these challenges with a full roster. And this is one more step on the road to that process.
Jim, what do you make of Corker holding the vote when he knew that he wouldn't have all of his Republicans and he needed all of them to get this confirmed? Johnny Isakson, I just saw him on TV being interviewed this morning about Ronny Jackson because he's on the Veterans Committee. He could have just had the vote today.
You know, I'd like – sorry, this is an odd statement for me, Greg. I'd like to believe this was incompetence. I want to have faith that this was just Bob Corker being utterly oblivious to what's going on in his committee and being an oversight. But sadly, I can't. And I can't help but suspect that this is another form of the passive-aggressive Bob Corker venting his frustrations at the administration. Instead of trying to help things run as smoothly as possible, he's not afraid to I mean, again, if he doesn't report out of committee favorably, it doesn't really change anything. Still goes to a vote to the floor. Life goes on. He still likely has become Secretary of State. But it's a bit of an embarrassment. It's worth noting, you know, if you point out that, you know, I mean, Rand Paul voted for John Kerry, right? And the idea that, you know, John Kerry of the global test, Greg, the idea that he's, you know, completely qualified and perfect for this job, but Mike Pompeo isn't, and that Mike Pompeo is some sort of terrible, abominable selection for Secretary of State just doesn't make any sense. And, you know, but apparently Corker just wasn't that motivated to avoid that outcome.
All right, let's move on to the bad martini now, and this is bad in a number of respects. Yesterday afternoon, we got the horrific news. In fact, it might have even been late morning, Toronto time, that a driver had careened onto the sidewalk and intentionally for about a mile was running down pedestrians. And in the end, 10 people are dead, 15 injured. Let's hope that there are no more fatalities among those injured. The police has come to the startling conclusion, Jim, that this was deliberate since the guy kept going for a mile. But since this happened, perhaps north of the border, but certainly because it involved a van instead of a gun, and because we don't right now think that there's any link to terrorism, the media has completely forgotten about it. So if a mentally ill person kills 10 people with a gun, it's a major news story. You fly your anchors down to the site, and it's wall-to-wall coverage for days. If it happens with a vehicle, you get about 30 seconds the next morning.
Yeah, this has really been kind of nagging at me, Greg, because if you think about it, you know, first of all, there's been a lot of sudden guys suddenly driving onto the sidewalks in busy city streets and running down a bunch of people in a bunch of major world cities. And in some of these cases, it has been jihadists. It has been very explicitly people who are inspired by ISIS or some other Islamist ideology and are trying to run down as many infidels as possible. A couple other ones where they've said, no, it's not that reasoning. Don't worry, it's just a garden variety crazy person, which I'm sure doesn't make much of a difference to those who lost loved ones and isn't really all that reassuring to the rest of us. And I wrote about this a bit in The Jolt today. Greg, and it's one of those days where I have the observation but not the helpful recommendation to go with it. I'm only doing half the job, I suppose you could say. But I was thinking about the Austin bomber of a couple weeks ago, who apparently was not a jihadist. There was initial belief that perhaps he had some. Two of the first victims were African-American. People speculated about whether it was white supremacist related in some way. It does not appear to have been that. The various other cases where we've seen mass shooting, where it just seems to be, oh, it's not a known wolf in the jihadist sense, but it's a known wolf in the sense of someone who had serious mental problems or deep rooted emotional issues, and some sort of real problem that you know spurred them to take this violent act of lashing out at random innocent people. And I kind of started to wonder, I mean, like, you know, like we all have, maybe this is a level of rage and, you know, mental disconnection that we're just never going to, you know, those of us who are sane or like to think of ourselves as being sane, will never quite relate to. But the sense of like, oh, we're mad and we, you know, yell or we, you know, kick something or, you know, and the idea that people suddenly decide, oh, no, I'm going to make bombs and mail them, right? Or I'm going to get into a van and I'm going to rent and I'm or going to drive down the street and try to run down as many people as possible. There's something, I don't know if this is being spread like psychologically virally, but it just seems like there's this really weird, unnerving trend of people basically committing acts that terrorize, you know, whether or not they consider themselves members of ISIS or they're doing it in the name of a cause, they do something to lash out at random strangers and to inspire terror and fear in the hearts of other people. But there's not that much of a discernible reason. Now, apparently just the last few hours, they've been speculating that the motivation of this van driver in Toronto may have been similar to the shooter back in, I believe it was, you know, Isla Vista, California, who basically had angry at women. Couldn't get a date, couldn't get a girlfriend, felt rejected. And rather than, you know, a state that many, many men, if it will look back in their younger years and say, yes, I was lonely, or yes, I had times where I, you know, the girl I really liked didn't like me, heart sickness, heartbroken, however you want to characterize it. They decide that's just too much they can bear, and that they have to kill lots of people in order to register their anger over this cosmic injustice that they can't get the girl that they want. It's a really unnerving, creeping set of kind of this creeping mentality that if life doesn't give you what you want, well, then you have to lash out and kill people. And the idea that people say, oh, it's not terrorism. Well, it may not be Islamist terrorism, but it sure as heck was intended to terrorize. So, sad, depressing news and kind of frightening. And this idea of, you know, oh, don't worry, it wasn't Islamist. Great. But that still doesn't change anything for the people who are dead or the people who are wondering how long it will be until someone else gets behind the wheel of a truck or a van and decides to run down people in some sort of, you know, going out in a blaze of glory, you know, angry rampage or something like that.
Yeah, it's also reminiscent of the shooting not that long ago in Maryland, where the boy shot the girl because their relationship had ended in a way, obviously, that he didn't appreciate. And so every crisis just seems existential for these obviously troubled people, Jim. And you want to get them to a point where they can see the bigger picture, that they're here for something more than just lashing out when something doesn't go their way. And personally, I would point them to the book With All the Answers, the best-selling book of all time, even though GQ no longer thinks that it's worth reading. Let's move on to our crazy martini now. And Jim, unfortunately, we've seen this story before in the UK. We saw it last year with Charlie Gard. His parents desperately tried to get him to the United States for treatment that they thought might have a chance at helping to save their son's life. The British government, which runs the healthcare system, said, no, we've done everything we can. There's no hope for this kid. We got to take him off of life support. The parents lost all the appeals, and eventually Charlie Gard died. Only took about a day or so, actually. Now we're dealing with the story of Alfie Evans, a very similar story. This is The Guardian. Alfie Evans, the severely ill toddler whose life support machine was switched off on Monday, could immediately be flown to a children's hospital in Rome for treatment if a last-ditch appeal succeeds, a solicitor involved in the case has said. The child's parents were granted an emergency hearing before a high court judge on Tuesday afternoon after they said the 23-month-old boy had been breathing unassisted since his life support was removed. Tom Evans and Kate James will ask that an order preventing Alfie's removal from Alderhay Hospital in Liverpool be lifted. Roger Kiska, a solicitor for the group Christian Concern, said medical transportation was available to take Alfie to Italy, where he has been offered treatment if they win the appeal. They say everything's in place on board the plane. Everything's ready to go in Italy. He's been granted Italian citizenship in order to facilitate this move. But life support had been withdrawn from Alfie on Monday, who has a rare degenerative brain disease, after an appeal to the high court was turned down. So, Jim, obviously the big takeaway here is when the government controls who lives and dies, it becomes very, very frightening, as opposed to when parents or family members or the patient themselves has that power. The British government has been doing some really ludicrous things here, from, you know, knife control and scissor control and all sorts of other things. But when it comes to life and death, this sort of government intrusion is more frightening than anything else.
Yeah. Just two other kind of late additions to add. We're giving this having this conversation around 11:40 on Tuesday morning. My understanding, apparently, according to UK press accounts, there is a hospital that is outside, an air ambulance that is outside the hospital, ready to take him to a hospital in Italy that has volunteered to continue treatment and attempt other things, other methods of attempting to treat this. I'm also seeing some conversations amongst doctors who point out that if you have a child you think will not live without a respirator, you remove the respirator, and it was about 6 p.m. Monday. It is, they said, is, you know, around 11:40 now. It's about, and the UK is about 6 hours ahead of us. You can do. We're now coming up on 24 hours, right, in which the problem for this child at this point now, you simply would have labored breathing. Why would you not want to reattach access to oxygen? I'm kind of curious about how this doesn't run afoul of the Hippocratic Oath and first do no harm and things like that. And as you said, the parents are making the argument that their child is basically being detained in this hospital. When you won't allow them to leave and seek treatment elsewhere, that sure as heck does sound like being detained. If the hospital believes it's done all it can do and there's nothing more to be done, that's fine. But don't deny parents the opportunity to seek other treatments from other hospitals that are volunteering and saying, hey, we think we can do something to help this child. It is chilling. It is unnerving. And look, we have these arguments periodically in our culture. And we're, you know, some of us make slippery slope arguments of like, well, wait a second. Once you decide that this kind of life isn't worth living, how do we know that definition won't expand? And we're assured, oh, no, 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 don't worry about it. There's nothing, there will never be this sort of thing. Well, now you have over in the UK a situation in which the state has basically decreed this child must die. And now, of course, there's this great little wrinkle in the plan that the child is not dying, indicating that perhaps this is not as hopeless and imminently terminal a situation as the doctors originally diagnosed. So we'll be hoping and praying for this one, but it's definitely a grim and one might almost say Orwellian set of circumstances over there in the United Kingdom.
Jim, we obviously congratulate Prince William and his wife on the birth of their child, who's, who seems to be perfectly healthy. If that child was not healthy, the royal baby, do you think there'd be any problem getting that child somewhere else to where it needs treatment?
I was going to say, to ask the question is to answer it, isn't it, Greg?
Yeah, I would say so. Asked and answered. God bless Alfie Evans, his family. Let's hope that it turns out the right way here. Jim, we'll call time for today, and we'll reconvene tomorrow. See you then.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and please tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.